Alan's voice took on the patient, but slightly strained tone, of a teacher who is attempting to explain a simple fact to a somewhat backward student. Of course you will be ridiculed. Ridicule is the protective barrier which the timid or the ignorant erect between themselves and any possibility which frightens or disturbs them. Can you name any man of your planet who has ever accomplished anything of great value to your people, who was not scorned and ridiculed by some? It is the price exacted from every individual who is as much as one step in advance of his fellows, in thought or in action. There is a saying in the records of an earlier civilization, which I believe should be on the frontispiece of every book of philosophy. It is easier to ridicule than to investigate, but it is not as profitable. Yes, you will be called a liar by some and a fool by others. Some will call you both. Some will make it their business to question, deny and attack almost everything you may say, even though its truth may be obvious. There are many problems you will have to face, but remember that they are not exclusively yours. They have been faced and met by every individual who has ever offered his knowledge and his services to his neighbors, in the attempt to advance the culture of the race. Remember also that you will have friends. More friends than you ever dreamed of. While it is true, as you say, that there are too many who fear any change in their way of life, there are others, more than you think, who sense the critical position of your society and your civilization, and are searching diligently for a remedy. They will look before they laugh, and for everyone who looks, you will have another friend. Never discount the power of thought. When you have friends, you are never alone, no matter where you may be. Every mind that is for you will be with you, and will give you added courage and ability. I hope so. I said, I have a feeling that if I do as you say, I am going to need plenty of both. No landing on the White House lawn, even though you are not yet completely adapted to our environment. You should, by now, be able to tolerate a short stay, especially if you do not have to pretend to be one of us. Why don't you just set a small landing craft down on the White House lawn some morning, ask for worldwide communication facilities, and give your information and advice to the whole world at once? Such a simple solution is only wishful thinking on your part, Alan replied. We have discussed this before. If you think a little, you will see that there are many reasons, both general and specific, why such a course would not be successful. In the first place, there is the psychological aspect. If we were to appear as members of a superior race, coming from above to lead the people of your world, our arrival would seriously disrupt the ego balance of your society. Tens of millions of your people, in their desperate need to avoid being demoted to second place in the universe, would go to any lengths to disprove, or simply deny our existence. If we took steps to force the acceptance of our reality upon their consciousness, about 30% of the people would insist upon considering us as gods, and would attempt to place upon us all responsibility for their own welfare. This is a responsibility we would not be permitted to assume, even if we were able to discharge it, which of course, we are not. Most of the remaining 70% would adopt the belief that we were potential tyrants or dictators, who were planning to enslave their world, and many would begin to seek means to destroy us. If any great and lasting good is to come from our efforts, they must be led by your own people, or at least by those who are accepted as such. This is why I must become one of you before I can be of assistance. In flying over your White House and especially in landing upon its lawn, we would, as you know, be in direct violation of several stringent laws created to protect the heads of your government from possible danger from the air. There is, as a matter of fact, no way at all in which we could legally approach your people. We could not even fly through your rare space without violating several of your laws. We could not even communicate by radio with any of your stations, nor could they communicate with us because our transmitter has not been licensed by your people. The real problem lies in the fact that your people are not yet ready to accept even the possibility of extraterrestrial life and intelligence. Consequently, they make no provision whatever in their laws for the arrival of beings whose existence they continue to deny. It is obvious that when the time comes for me to take up residence among your people, I will be doing so in violation of a number of laws. We deeply regret this fact, but there seems to be no way to avoid it. What we regret even more, however, is that you and at least one other member of your race must share in these violations. Not only must you know of them, but in some cases, they cannot be committed without your active participation. If I am to travel about your Earth, which I will need to do, I must have the travel document known as a passport. In order to obtain one, I must have a certificate showing the time and place of my birth. Since my origin was actually extraterrestrial, there is no legal way in which I can obtain either a birth certificate or a passport, yet I must have both. It was therefore necessary to find, somewhere in your country, a county registrar who could understand the need for my being here, and be willing to assist, even at some risk to himself. Our psychoanalysts have been busy with that problem for almost 3 months, and have only recently found an official who seems to have the mental qualities required. We will arrange for you to meet him, and you must become well acquainted, since it will be up to you to conduct the negotiations. Our head shrinkers, as you would call them, with their professional excuse for probing minds, often make interesting discoveries which would otherwise remain unsuspected. While searching for the proper county recorder to assist me in my need for a birth certificate, they discovered two who made a practice of preparing and filing false birth certificates for citizens of the Soviet Union who wished to obtain positions in your defense industries. Since these men were performing this unlawful function solely for personal gain, and not through any feeling of patriotism or other possibly justifying purpose, I could probably have purchased a certificate from either one of them without much difficulty, but there is always an unacceptably high degree of hazard in dealing with anyone who makes a habit of violating any accepted code of law, simply for personal gain. We have made a careful analysis of the steps to be taken so that I may move easily and unnoticed among your people. The goal is simply to achieve the greatest possible degree of normalcy. For example, one can neither be noticeably rich nor noticeably poor, since the first state arouses envy, and the second rouses pity, either of which tends to focus attention upon their case. I must have a profession, or at least a gainful occupation, preferably one which is generally known to and accepted by the public, but which is normally conducted in private, and without advertising or display. The ideal occupation would be that of a purchasing agent in an international trading concern. Such a position would furnish a means of livelihood, a good background cover, and an excellent excuse to visit other countries whenever it might become necessary. It would also provide a non-political contact with most of the governments of your world, since every country, whether friendly or not, has things which it wishes, either to buy or to sell. And anyone who is in a position to arrange such a purchase or sale, is always welcome in the country. The average businessman of your country has a moderate amount of money on deposit in some banking institution, and, since I am to become an average businessman, I must also have such an account. It seems that most of your money systems are related to the value of gold. I will therefore arrange to have a few pounds of the metal delivered to you here, so that you can exchange it for your currency and open an account in my name, at whatever bank you may choose. For the first time, I felt the need to interrupt. Not gold, I said. Gold has too many legal strings attached, and anyone who offers it for sale, must be able to prove its source. If you happen to have some small ingots of platinum handy, they will do nicely. The demand for platinum somewhat exceeds the supply, so that it is not difficult to sell, and its present value is several times that of gold. Very well, Alan replied, platinum it will be, although it seems strange to think it is as having so much value among your people. During the last few hundreds of generations, the demand for various metals for the construction of space homes has become so great that entire uninhabited planets have been disassembled for their Nicolaian cores. Near the center of a planet, the heavier elements will, of course, be found in considerably greater proportions than those which exist near the surface. While platinum is an excellent substance for the plating of surfaces that will be exposed to corrosion, and most of our ships are plated with it, it has few other uses in our technology, and its value is only a little greater than that of copper, which has many uses. We will work out the many small problems and various details of adaptation to your social structure, as the need arises, but, As I mentioned earlier, it will be some months yet before I can take up residence on your planet and, unless a few small balancing forces are applied soon, there may be no society, no civilization and no population to visit. There are several of your world leaders who seem to feel that the brink of war is the only spot from which a nation can properly discuss peace. Such brinks are notoriously unstable, and many a nation has slipped over without intending to do so. I realize the danger to our civilization that the possibility of nuclear warfare poses, I said. Everyone whose work is in the scientific field does. Almost every one of the top scientists of our country has, at one time or another, made the statement that full-scale nuclear war would certainly result in the destruction of our civilization, and the death of most of the world's population, but no one seems to pay much attention to them. Next headline, physical, social, and spiritual science. That is because they have stated only the problem, without offering any solution. Alan said. Actually, the possibility of atomic warfare on your planet, while it is an immediate danger, is not the basic problem, it is merely a symptom, and few illnesses can be cured by treating only the symptoms. Your civilization is facing a great problem and, during the last few years, it has become a critical one. Its existence is not the fault of any race, creed or political ideology. It is a problem which develops, sooner or later, in the development of every civilization, no matter where or when it may begin. When life begins upon any planet, it first appears in the simplest possible forms, but as the ages pass, some forms of that life constantly tend to become more complex and more sentient. At some point in time, a race will appear which has what you would describe as the human traits. They include the consciousness of existence, the need for purpose in life and the realization of a power and intelligence greater than that of any living thing. A civilization may be said to begin when such a genus appears. The quest for knowledge and a purpose in life follows a broad spectrum which can be divided into three major sections for the purpose of discussion and better understanding. These sections can be defined as follows. 1. The physical or material science, which deals with the needs and desires of the physical body of man, and the nature of the physical universe in which he dwells. In this division are the subjects of physics, chemistry, astronomy etc., as well as the study of the manufacture of the endless number of products necessary to the well-being, the comfort and the security of man. 2. The social science, which deals with the relationship between man and his fellow man, and with the means by which this relationship may be made more successful, more productive and more enduring. In this division are the studies of society, government, psychology, the non-material phases of economics, etc. 3. The spiritual science, which deals with the relationship between man and the great creative power and infinite intelligence which pervades and controls all nature, and which your people refer to as God. All of the science in the universe, all of the search for truth and the pursuit of understanding will come under one of these headings or divisions. We cannot draw a sharp dividing line between them, of course, because they overlap each other, but the fundamental laws which govern them are the same for all divisions. If any civilization in the universe is to develop fully and successfully, each of the branches of advancement must be pursued with equal effort and diligence. The spiritual and social sciences, however, must come first. There can be no development of the material science except upon a foundation of spiritual and social science. You can prove this to yourself if you consider the difference between man and the animal. There are some, of course, who will say that there is no real difference, that man is just an animal who has acquired greater intelligence than the rest, and so has been able to achieve a material science. The fact is that there are several specific differences between any man and any animal. One of these is that the animal has no spiritual or social science, and consequently has never developed a material science, and never will, because there is no foundation upon which such a science could be built. A few of your insects, such as the ant and the bee, you call them the social insects, have developed a rudimentary form of social science, to the extent that they live together in large numbers, work for the common good, and have a form of discipline that is common to all. As a result, they have developed a very limited form of material science in that they do create simple structures in which they store food for a future time of need. The fact that they have no spiritual science, however, has proven a complete bar to any further development. They have not advanced a single step in thousands of years, and of course, they never will because they have long since reached the limits of the structure which can be erected upon their minute foundation. Mankind, on the other hand, no matter where or when he may come into being, is endowed with the innate realization of the infinite intelligence and the creative power of the Supreme Mind, even though he may not yet be able to understand. During the many stages of his development, man's attitude toward this power may vary from fear and resentment in the beginning, to reverence and love in the final stages, but always he will have the instinctive need to learn more of the nature of the creative power. Thus the spiritual science has its beginning in the very dawn of human intelligence. From the realization that man can improve the conditions of his life only through cooperation, come the first tribal gatherings which represent the beginning of the social science. From the foundation provided by these two sciences, the superstructure of the material science begins to emerge, and here also begins the great problem. The development of the material science, being constantly stimulated by the ever-increasing needs and desires of the body, takes place at a constantly increasing rate. If you consider the technological advance of your science during the last 30 of your years, you will see that they exceeded the advance of the previous 100 years, and that that advance, in turn, exceeded the advance of the previous 1,000 years. The social and spiritual sciences, on the other hand, progress normally, only directly with time, and even this rate of progress is not always maintained. Eventually you have the problem of a huge and massive structure, growing at an ever-increasing rate, standing upon, and supported only by a foundation which is growing at a much smaller rate. Unless some means can be found to stimulate the growth of the foundation, a time will inevitably come when it can no longer support the structure, and the structure will collapse upon the foundation, bringing ruin and destruction to both. This total collapse of civilization has occurred before upon this planet, and your present civilization has now entered the stage where it is quite likely to occur again unless some outside stimulus is given. The entire population of your planet is now in constant danger of total destruction by an agency which you yourselves have created, with great labor and diligence, and at great expense in time and money. Why should a race be threatened by its own creations? The answer, of course, is simply that the race has not progressed far enough in the foundation sciences to enable its people to control their own creations, and so their creations control them. Most of the thinkers of your race are well aware of the dangers inherent in the use of nuclear weapons, but there is another aspect of the problem which is not so well recognized. Unless the present degree of tension between your major nations can be eased within a reasonable amount of time, the very existence of such weapons will eventually bring about the downfall of your civilization, or at least your society, even though they may never be used. Civilizations are built and maintained by men of vision who think and work for the future. What man will be willing to dedicate his life and his work to the benefit of generations yet unborn, when the entire race may be wiped out in the next 24 hours? Unless some lowering of tension and security of future can be achieved within the next decade, the motto of the following generation is likely to be, "Let us eat, drink and raise hell, for tomorrow we die." Already many articles have appeared in your newspapers and magazines commenting upon what they describe as juvenile delinquency. Some writers place the blame upon the parents, some upon the schools, while others blame the church or the state. Actually, none of these agencies are especially at fault. Youth is particularly sensitive to conditions of insecurity, any of your psychologists will verify this, and never in the history of your race has the future been less secure. By the time two more generations of your people have been born and reared under the constant threat of imminent annihilation, the state of apprehension will have evolved into one of deep-seated resentment against those elements of society which were responsible for the danger. The resentment will manifest itself in many ways, but principally in various forms of passive or violent revolt against existing beliefs, morals, institutions, and almost all forms of constituted authority. I can readily understand the problem, I said, but what is the solution? There are many people who sense the hazard of our present course, but their advice varies. Some say we should halt the progress of our material science. Some have even suggested that we do away with the material science entirely and go back to nature living as the animals do. If you had begun to erect a large new building, Alan replied, and you discovered that, through a miscalculation, the foundation was not strong enough to support the finished structure, would you solve the problem by tearing down that part of the structure which was already built? Not likely. The logical course would be to seek means to enlarge and strengthen the foundation. The progress of the material science cannot successfully be halted. Either it will go forward or it will go back. If it goes back, it will collapse, because the principal supporting members will be the first to weaken under a program of retrogression. There is nothing basically wrong with your material science. It can expand and progress to horizons as yet undreamed of, if only your people will provide a foundation capable of supporting it. And if they do not? I asked. Then your civilization will cease to be, Alan replied slowly. It will destroy itself in a holocaust that will leave few survivors. Those who do survive will have neither the will nor the ability to rebuild their science or their technology. In a few generations, their descendants will have returned almost to the level of the animal. Then the process of evolution will begin again. In 10 to 15,000 years, another civilization and technology will emerge. They too will face the same problems, and have the same opportunity for their solution. If it fails, it too will go down. This is an immutable law of the universe, but as you see, it is one which operates according to the free choice of the race. Your race and your culture are not doomed to extinction. They may continue upon their upwards course until they have left this danger behind them forever. The choice, you see, is yours. There is little doubt, I said, which choice the people would make, if they were aware of the alternatives between which they were choosing. Precisely. Alan replied, that is why we are here, and that is why you are here. Lemuria, Atlantis, and the artificial structures on Mars, as I mentioned before, a portion of my direct ancestry were in a group of survivors of the last complete collapse of civilization on your planet. This was more than 1,000 generations in the past. But even then they had developed a technology which was, in some respects at least, considerably more advanced than yours. They followed, and made use of all aspects of the natural laws, instead of pitting one against the other, as you have fallen into the habit of doing. As a result, their science was somewhat simpler than yours, and yet they could accomplish many things which you would not even think of attempting. With all their advancement, however, they too, failed to realize the absolute necessity of maintaining an equal development of the social and spiritual values. A political and social cleft developed between the two principal nations of that era. As I mentioned to you during our first discussion, the friction between the two increased yearly, until at last it exploded into a war of annihilation. There was no question of victory or defeat, they simply destroyed each other. There were few survivors, and the level of radiation of the entire surface of the planet had been raised beyond human tolerance. This did not mean that all survivors were doomed to immediate death from the radiation, but it did mean the progressive deterioration of the mental and biological functions. This, together with the large number of undesirable mutations produced in succeeding generations, would bring their level of existence down, at least to that of the Stone Age, if not even farther. On a high plateau, in what is now the land of Tibet, six of the surviving aerial craft were landed by their crews, for a conference to determine what, if anything, could be done to preserve the remnants of the race. It was suggested that an attempt be made to reach another planet. The aerial craft then in use were capable of traveling in space, and had frequently been used to reach elevations of a few hundreds of miles, but no attempt had yet been made to leap the vast gulf between the planets, and the crew members were far from certain that such an attempt could succeed. The planet which you now know as Mars, was then in conjunction with the Earth, and preliminary estimates seemed to indicate that the crossing could be made. At that time, the surface conditions of temperature, atmosphere, water, etc., were somewhat better suited for human survival than the conditions your astronomers report to exist today. A vote was taken, and the members of the crews of four of the craft elected to take the huge gamble in the hope of preserving, thereby, at least a portion of the culture of the race. The remaining crews decided to remain on Earth. They believed that, because of the elevation of the plateau on which they were gathered, and the relatively low level of radiation at that point, they could continue to live in this area without suffering complete physical or mental degeneration in themselves or their descendants. I can see the question forming in your mind, so I will explain that this race had achieved perfect equality of the sexes, and both were about equally represented in this council, and in the crews of the ships. Of the four craft which essayed the Great Leap, three arrived safely at their destination. There is no record in our history as to the fate of the fourth. For many generations the grim struggle for survival demanded the entire time and energy of the people. These were the dark ages of the new race, and we have relatively little knowledge of this period. The original crew members, immediately after their arrival upon the new planet, compiled a carefully written history of the races of Earth, documenting the reasons for their downfall. Through the intervening centuries, this history has been preserved. It is known as the Great Lesson, and is still the first thing taught to the descendants of that race when they begin to prepare themselves for active life. As the battle for survival against the harsh environment was gradually won, the development of the material science resumed its normal pattern, and technology spurted ahead. With the lessons of the past constantly before the people, however, the material values were carefully maintained in their proper relationship to the social and spiritual values. Space travel and space dwelling became more and more common until the planet was almost completely abandoned. After all, living in space is so much simpler, safer and more convenient than struggling to survive the whims and often deadly perversities of a planet. Like all space-dwelling races, we are now essentially independent of planets. Some of our craft are very large, judged by your standards, since they are many times larger than your largest ships, and we have the knowledge and ability to produce all of the necessities and comforts of our physical lives within our craft. We have no personal need to approach or land upon any planet, except occasionally to obtain raw materials for new construction, and that we usually obtain from asteroids or uninhabited satellites. The satisfaction of our physical needs now requires but little time or effort. Consequently, we are able to devote much of our time and energy to the assistance of those races which have not yet passed the critical point in their development. The craft which brought me here, and from which I am now speaking, is devoted entirely to this purpose. In a few months, when my preparations are complete, I will become one of your people. In the meantime, you have many things to do, and I am keeping you from doing them. Just a moment, I interrupted. In the beginning of this discussion you said that I should arrange to appear on radio and television programs, give interviews to newspapers, and write a book. You have given me considerable ammunition for all of these activities, but there should be a keyword or a specific goal around which to organize the presentation. Of course, Alan replied. One of the most important words in your language is frequently being overlooked or bypassed through the use of words which seem to be similar in meaning, but which may actually mislead. The word is understanding, and the words with which it is often confused are knowledge, wisdom, love and charity. All of these are desirable characteristics, but none can take the place of understanding. In the Bible which you sent me, as in most of your books of wisdom and religion, your people are advised, and even commanded to, love God, and their fellow men. This would be excellent advice, if only it could be followed, but unfortunately, love is an emotion that is not subject to the will. No one can actually love anyone else simply because he is advised, or even commanded to do so, nor can he because of any reward that may be offered. Imagine, for example, that a very wealthy man should offer you a great sum of money if you could love your next-door neighbor. Entranced by the thought of all that money, you would probably exclaim, "Of course I will. Why, for that much money I'll love that stupid, no good so-and-so, if it kills me." And it probably would. You might make a very good pretense of love, complete with all the outward symptoms, but in your heart there would be no change. In fact, you would eventually begin to despise the individual even more than before, because he is now the living symbol of your own hypocrisy. Understanding must come first, before there can be any genuine love, charity, or even wisdom.